Oh man. So I think I feel like I'm getting sick. I can't tell. I'm like right on the precipice of like if I eat one donut today, I'll get sick. But if I eat a bunch of kale, maybe I can sort of pull out of this nosedive.
Yeah, I am ex in exactly the same position. I don't know if you can tell from my voice, but I'm a little verklempt in the chest.
We're very mucus. We're two just big mucus boys today. Just two big mucus boys doing a podcast.
Yep, the Mucus Boys really sounds like a boy, one of those local businesses that advertises on cable TV. Like the people that really didn't realize that their last name shouldn't be the lead out for their business.
What would you get at the neighborhood Mucus Boys?
You know, it would be something completely unrelated. It would be like an appliance store.
Like a tire, you get your tires rotated.
Right, you know, like the mechanics. You know, like they'd be really good mechanics too. It's just that it's like Jerry, you know, Jerry and Tom Mucus. You know, like it's spelled a different way. It's an ethnic name, and they just so they're like, of course we're going to use this for our business name and all of our radio ads, and just nobody ever told them that's not appropriate. We had a little, you know, back and forth on Twitter where, you know, I said, hey, here's the new podcast. We talk about Marvel Universe. And people were saying, you know, what team are you on? Are you team Iron Man or team Captain America? And, you know, I stirred the turd a little bit by saying, have you ever heard that expression before? Stirred the turd?
No, I'm thinking about how much I like it though.
Did I just make that up? Is that
I think you coined it. I'm going to go with you coined it. Oh, it may have been. I think it may have been Abraham Lincoln.
that was Mark Twain.
Winston Churchill famously coined the term "stirred the turd."
But you know, somebody said, "What team are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm Team Captain America, like all right-thinking people." And you jumped in a while later and said, "So you're against regulation?" And I'm like, "Oh shit, okay," you know. And but then somebody actually, and this is rare as seeing a unicorn, somebody in Twitter stepped in and said and made like the perfect salient point, which is in the universe in which they exist, Captain America's choice is the right choice. In our universe, that's not the case because these universes aren't the same. Whereas, like in that Marvel universe, in that cosmology, you know, and I think the person really hit it on the head, which is the government in that universe has proven consistently shittier at dealing with and making these choices. They are either reactionary or fearful or both. Whereas the superheroes in question, you know, are consistently on the side of right. And that's largely for narrative reasons. It makes a better story. But the fact remains that that is what makes Captain America right in that world. But this world, you know, is very much different. And when they brought that up, and I'm like, oh shit, actually, yeah, I'm totally on Cap's side. However, I'm also I am very much for regulation because that's why, you know, that's why the banks are shitting all over the place is because, you know, regulation has been eased up. That is the purpose of government is to act as, you know, you know, it's to keep people from being a dick to each other.
Well, I don't buy that argument because
Okay, let's
the
have
thing
it.
is, like, because here's the thing. I'm not watch I understand that any, you know, comic book or sci-fi or fantasy world is different than our world. Obviously, I understand that. And I watch, but why do you care about a comic book world. Like, why am I investing? Why am I paying my $10 and going to the theater to see it? It's because I'm connecting to something in my world. It's because I'm learning something about what it is, what, you know, that's the brilliant, that's the most brilliant and socially relevant thing, in my opinion, that sci-fi and fantasy and genre fiction can do, is that they can give you this, like, outside, you, it lets you step outside of your culture and your moment in history just enough to see into something essential about yourself, right? It's this prism. And when you look back through that prism at your own circumstances, you see them in a way that you, that's different than before. And I get, I understand that that the Marvel universe isn't our universe. And I understand that the Cap, you know, whatever the thing this week that Cap is secretly Hydra or whatever. I people were getting so mad about that. And I understand it's fiction. I get, I mean, that's an obvious point. And I get the ways that it's different, but also, like, why am I watching this movie if I'm not supposed to have a political opinion about it that's informed by my actual political beliefs and my actual concerns? And it's not, to me, it's not even an issue of necessarily regulation. It's just that it's like, I mean, the regulation is the less boring part. If the question is, these superheroes are ostensibly in the Marvel universe, they're the most powerful sort of military force on the planet, and who gets to employ the use of force? Like, do people, like, typically, like, what we want to have in an enlightened capitalist democracy is when there's a war, when there's a battle, or when you're gonna have this employ the use of force, people vote on it, they get representation. You know, in theory, the country elected George W. Bush that lied to us and got us into two disastrous land wars, but in the Middle East, but. It's like, we're in Marvel, nobody votes for the superheroes to go fight people. There was never any option of, like, making peace with our enemies. They're just these, like, crazy powerful vigilantes that go around the world having super battles.
Right. But again, there is a big difference, because in our world, you know, the people we go to war with are other countries. Whereas in the Marvel universe, like, Godzilla appears. Well, you know, Godzilla actually doesn't appear in the Marvel universe, but, you know, Skrull attack, aliens from space. And, you know, in that situation, you know, convening a specialty meeting of the UN to vote as to whether or not the Avengers can go into Latvian airspace, I mean, the entire country has been turned into a sheet of glass by that point.
Well, this is, I mean, that's an interesting question in our actual world. So let's say we do make contact with aliens, right? Let's say SETI finds something and we get to send them a radio signal. Who makes first contact? The UN, the yeah. US, the president, some guy in his basement?
Yeah, it's, well, I mean, I think we can all agree that the military is going to do it first. And I think most of us will also agree that the military is not the person I want representing me to the universe at large.
Right. And I totally agree. It's like, the person who's going to represent us is the person who has the best technology and the best and the most sort of power to power everyone out. That's how decisions get made. And in theory, in like a democratic republic, there's a distribution of that power to the citizens, where we have a military, but they're not autonomous. They, at the end of the day, you know, the president is the commander in chief. The military answers to the president, and the president answers to the people. And I think that I am very, I mean, you know, obviously in the Civil War movie, the details were constructed so that Iron Man was, like, clearly supposed to be the bad guy, and regulation was clearly, you were supposed to be rooting against, you know, locking up the superheroes in the super prison or whatever. But I think that, my own politics, my own beliefs are actually that some version of the Sokovia Accords, or some version of trying to give regular non-super people representation in the way that we have first contact with aliens, is, like, pretty important to me.
You know, and the truth is, I do agree. You know, some sort of sensible regulation. And again, you're right. Iron Man is definitely painted to be. And here's what makes it a good movie, you know, or whether or not it's a great movie, you know, or here's what makes it a good choice narratively, is he's not supposed to be the villain. He's a good person who's wrong. You know, and in the movie, he is definitely painted to be wrong. Now, what's interesting to me is why he's wrong. Because I've been thinking about this since last week. And, you know, arguably, you know, you know, Captain America, I think, is, you know, he's easier to love. But Tony Stark is a much more interesting character because Tony Stark is a hot goddamn mess. You know, in all sorts of ways, you know, his arc is that of redemption. You know, he started as a fucking war profiteer, amoral, you know, son of a bitch who kind of had an awakening and is trying to do right in the world. Despite the fact that he's a flawed individual. That by itself is a compelling story, but what's a much more interesting, or even more interesting to that than that to me, is the fact that if you watch him over the course of the Iron Man movies and over the course of these Avenger movies, you know, he is central to a lot of the things getting fucked up. He makes bad choices.
Right. I was joking before Civil War, I was talking with, I think Jen from Cards, and I was like, we were talking about all the old Marvel movies, and I had just sort of blown through a bunch of them, like doing my homework, so I was prepared to see Civil War. And I was like, if they are chasing around one more MacGuffin Tesseract or fighting more of Iron Man's fucking rogue suits in this movie, I'm going to flip out. Like, that, like their entire world seems to be fighting rogue Iron Man suits and chasing around Tesseracts. If they just didn't have all the super stuff, if there weren't rogue Iron Man suits and they didn't care about the Tesseracts, all the conflict would be totally moot in the Marvel Universe.
Well, and see, that's a separate issue that I'd love to go down that road with you. It's like the importance of, or rather the reliance on apocalyptic things to raise the tension in these superhero movies. But specifically for Tony Stark, as opposed to Iron Man, right? For Tony Stark, who is also Iron Man, think of him as he progresses through these movies. He goes from a fuck up guy, he is kidnapped, has a near-death experience, is thrown into combat situations which he has absolutely no training for. Dude is a playboy. He is a spoiled, rich kid. Super smart, right? But what do we know about super smart people? They are riddled with mental disorders, you know?
Yeah, they spend a lot of their free time shouting at women on Twitter.
Well, let's not go that far. But, I mean, think of him. Just starting off, you know, this is not somebody who grew up tough and smart. And, you know, he's never been through military training, which means he doesn't have a lot of the tools that, say, Captain America does to approach combat situations healthily. And he's probably hasn't had access to the things Captain America has had access to in terms of, I mean, not to make it sound corny, but counseling. Tony Stark has been kidnapped, shot at, almost died several times, you know, and he's smart. He knows that he has almost fucking ended the world several times. And you see him slowly trying to, like, back away from being the guy who has to fix the world. You know, he's like, I can't do it all the time. I can't always be the guy that's going to save the world. We need something better so the world can save itself. He tries to do that, and then it gets fucked up, and it actually almost destroys the world. And he's like, God damn, this is proof that we need something bigger that will actually save the world. He keeps trying to pull back from being Iron Man, but he is forced to do it again and again out of raw necessity. And all the time, right, dude has major post-traumatic stress. He's never been to counseling. He was an alcoholic for a long time. Why? He's fucking self-medicating, right? And all this time, everybody, think about all the other people, right? People are like, oh, Scarlet Witch, your life must be so hard. We really want to talk to you and take care of you and be friends to you. Who the fuck is taking care of Tony Stark? his girlfriend leaves him, and everyone's like, oh shit, Tony, sucks to be you. And like the dude is an absolute train wreck. And he's still trying to do his best. He still gets pulled back in, and he's making terrible mistakes because there's not even a word for the amount of mental crisis that he is going through and the damage that he has taken internally. And that's what makes him a fascinating character. I hope they continue to capitalize on that arc. And you know, the one person who gets it is Captain America, who shows up at the end of the movie and says, you know, Tony, if you need me, I'm here to talk. You know, you can call me. And you know, on the surface is sort of like, yeah, okay, if the world needs to be saved, I'm still here. But like, Captain America is a fucking soldier. He knows that you kill people, and that does bad things to your head. And he knows that Tony has killed like way more people by trying to be way more good. You know, all Cap has is a fucking shield and like the ability to jump high. You know, Tony Stark actually has the ability. You know, he's effectively has more power than the president, and he knows he hasn't been elected. But what do you do? And so Tony is like, you know, I need regulation. You know, I need help. I need somebody to help me. That's what the whole fucking movie is about. Is him desperately saying, can somebody help me manage all this power?
I'm not a medical professional, as you know, Pat, but I still would recommend that if you're in a crisis that you don't build rogue Iron Man suits.
A lot of attention here to Marvel.
Yes.
And it's such a, you know, this issue, because again, I've been thinking about this a little bit. If you and the issue with Tony Stark and all these suits and these world cracking powers, is they're very big and therefore they're very complex and they bleed over into a lot of other areas like politics and governance and democracy and representation. But I'm going to actually take this same instance, right? And I'm going to move it over into, I'm going to take it over into DC for Batman, right? Because this reminded me, this little thing I was thinking about reminded me of what happened maybe a decade ago when I was hanging out with people. I used to be advisor for the local college feminist group. And they would meet at my house, and the conversations wandered all over. And at one point, we were talking about superheroes, and we ended up talking about Batman. And somebody got real hot, and they said, Batman doesn't kill people. There's a reason he doesn't kill people. That's what makes him Batman. That's what keeps him, like, effectively being a good person. It's his code. It's blah, 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 blah. And I said, that is an admirable code, especially for this world, right? The world we are currently living in. You know, somebody who doesn't kill people, I approve, right? Even if you're very morally sure that you're right, even if you're, you know, acting outside the bounds of the law, it shows that he still has a moral code and he's respecting all this whatever. I said, but here's the problem. He catches the Joker. He doesn't kill him. He puts him in jail. The Joker escapes. And then the Joker kills more people. And the thing is, this doesn't happen just one time. And this happens multiple times. Batman keeps catching the Joker. The Joker keeps getting locked away in various facilities. The Joker keeps escaping and keeps killing people. And I pointed out to the guy, I'm like, this means that Batman is wrong. Because again, got to remember who Batman is. He is supposed to be the smartest person He is the ultimate detective. He is somebody who's able to sense and identify and predict patterns. And that means, you know, after three times, even I can see that the Joker is going to fucking escape. Batman has to see it at least after two times, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that means if the Batman can predict that pattern,
mm-hmm,
and doesn't take steps to just fucking kill the Joker, he is complicit in the deaths of the people that the Joker kills.
Well, this is related to one of my favorite sort of superhero dilemmas, which I think it's called the Superman paradox or Superman dilemma, which is, you know, if you take just a purely utilitarian sort of point of view, what you're doing, which is like, you know, people go through life trying to maximize their utility and the correct policy is the policy that gives the most utility to the most people. The best use of Superman's time is saving people who are like on a collapsing bridge or on a, you know, plane that's crashing or something like that, right? And the world is so big that there's always people who are in peril who need Superman to save them. So it's actually never the utilitarian choice for Superman to like take a day off or read a book or have a relationship.
Yeah, that's how we got to that Batman discussion, you know, a decade ago with this guy. I think the Superman movie had just come out. And what I pointed out is they had that really, it's a great example. And here I'm going to shift gears slightly into storytelling and implication, like narrative implication, and how the insertion of one cool idea or a cool scene that's not properly thought out really fucks up your whole story. And that's what happened. I can't even remember which Superman it was. I think it was the first of the new ones where Superman, he's finally like caped up and he's like, all right, time to be Superman. And he flies up into outer space. You remember this scene? He goes up into outer space and he just listens and looks at the world. And he's able to see all the things that go wrong. And he rushes around and he's just fixing every damn thing. And it was an undeniably cool scene, undeniably cool concept. But the problem is that it leads to exactly what you talked about. This means that Superman doesn't just have the power. He has the ability to constantly be saving everyone who needs saving. Now, he's always had the power. You know, Superman in the 70s comics in Metropolis, he's always had the power to save people. However, in the scope of the universe that is contained in those comics, the world pretty much amounts to Metropolis.
Right.
He's not policing the whole world. And so there, he has the power, but the conflict in Superman actually comes from, will he find out in time? Also, the real conflict of Superman doesn't come from, can he save the day? It's, you know, his conflict is, I want to be a regular guy with a regular life, but being Superman is a responsibility. And so he like, hey, I'm on a date with Lois. Oh shit, a bus full of nuns. And he has to try to figure out a way to balance, you know, his job and his life because he has this secret. That's where a lot of the real tension comes from in Superman. But here's the thing, when you open up the scope of the world and the scope of his knowledge to include the entire Earth, you end up in that hole where it's like, this does mean if Superman stops to read the paper while he takes a shit, he's effectively killing people.
What about sleep, right? Superman's been awake for 40 hours, and there's two situations where people have been taken hostage. Does he get to sleep, or does he have to go save the hostages?
Exactly. You know, and like that actually would be like a really great Superman story to see is like, although honestly, it would... I honestly think that interesting Superman story would, if carried out properly, it would destroy the character of Superman.
It would be like the Battlestar Galactica version of Superman.
Yeah, yeah, it would. Where it's like, how long can I keep going, doing everything that needs to be done? There, you know, and since we've wandered into DC here, I have to say, if you haven't read it, I don't read a lot of standard superhero comics, But there was one called Red Sun. And what it is it shows Superman landing in Russia. And he's brought up on a farm, like a communist farm. And that's what he internalizes. And it's honestly, I think it's the best Superman story I've ever read.
Huh.
Head and shoulders better than anything else.
I'm going to put the links to all the stuff we've been talking about. So I'm going to put the link to Superman Red Sun. I'm going to put the link to the Superman problem that I described. And I'm also going to put a link to a little documentary on Radiolab about who on Earth, if we ever contact aliens, who actually gets to make first contact in the show notes for this episode, which are available with the show notes for every episode at unattendedconsequences.com.
The takeaway from this Batman Joker dilemma is not sometimes you got to kill a bitch. That's not the moral of the story. And that's the danger of narrative that is just representative, a narrative that is just didactic or just teaching.
Can I ask you, let me push you on the Batman paradox a little bit. So one of the things again, I'm always interested in our world. So like, what does Batman have to say about our justice system? What does Batman have to say about our world? What does Batman have to tell you if you're not a Batman? So, so as I am not, as you know, Pat, I'm not a Batman.
Oh, you spoiled it. Spoiled the mystery of whether or not you were.
I know.
Our numbers are going to go down now.
Yeah, spoiler alert, with regards to me being a Batman, I am not. That's one of my favorite, that's funny, this is a whole tangent, but I have a great superhero memory of, I went to see Spider-Man 2 with my friend Josh, who's a physicist, and at the end of the climax of that movie, his the bad guy, who I think is like Doc Ock, he like makes an artificial sun, and Spider-Man saves the day by pushing the sun into the lake. And Josh, we left that movie, and Josh was like incensed. He was like, if they put an artificial sun in that lake, it would have caused so much more steam. Like, it was totally unrealistic. And I was like, Josh, we just watched a movie about a Spider-Man. Like,
that's like when people read my book. And the one thing people always get pissed off about in Wise Man's Fear, they're like, how the hell could the ADEM actually not have a concept of fatherhood? That is the dumbest shit ever. Blah, 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 blah. I'm like, you realize Quoth just left the fairy realm where somebody knit him together a shadow cloak out of actual shadow. And this is the thing that is fucking up your verisimilitude? You know, like, he's actually done real for real magic.
But doesn't this just prove my thesis that the things that people respond to most strongly are the things that they can relate to their life? Like, what you're doing is you're positing what's a society look like without fatherhood. And some people have a strong that provokes them in a way where they're like, I don't want to think about this. It makes me feel bad. You know, I don't want to go down that route.
It is. And you're right. That's in some ways, that's the one of the major benefits of fantasy, I'd like to almost say speculative fiction. If you remove a topic from the world, it gives people the freedom to engage with it without a lot of their previous baggage.
I wanted to go back to the Batman thing that you were talking about for a second. So one of the things that's interesting of Batman is, as far as I know, I'm not a huge comics guy, so I don't know all of the Batman canon. But as far as I know, Batman never gets it wrong. Like you said, he's the perfect detective. And then when you start talking about things like the death penalty, should you ever just kill a criminal, or, you know, versus life imprisonment, or due process, having this vigilante go get someone, this is where it starts to crumble for me. Because unlike Batman, our actual justice system gets it wrong quite a bit. We imprison innocent people. We let guilty people go free. The error rate is, it's like if you want to think about it like an economist, are 100% of cases inaccurate? No. But are 0% of cases decided inaccurately? No. So it's somewhere in between 0 and 100. There's some number of cases where an innocent person goes to prison or you know, a guilty person walks free. And I think that's where it starts to get really interesting. Like, well, if you have a super detective who can perfectly solve every case with 100% accuracy and confidence every time, well, then why not just kill them, right? If it's, if you're sure it's the Joker and you're sure he did the crime, like, yeah, go ahead and kill him. But that's where you get that, that's where the fantasy world starts to, you know, fall apart a little bit for me, because then it's like, well, why don't we just, I don't actually know your views on this, but I'm very opposed to the death penalty. And the reason is, in our actual real world where you don't have a Batman solving crimes, I don't want to have the, I want there to be a 0% chance of executing an innocent person.
And yeah, I'm with you. I think Neil Gaiman, there was a quote in American Gods where somebody said, you know, I absolutely believe in the death penalty. You know, in a society where you can trust your courts to be infallible. And then their immediate follow-up statement was, I believe that anyone thinks our court system is infallible is a total idiot.
Right.
It was actually one of the better monologues out of that whole book. It was the I Believe monologue. And that's the problem with looking too closely at narrative, these narratives as, you know, in a didactic way, in a teaching way, or as parables, because it's like, given that Batman is always right, given that the Joker kills people, given that the Joker is going to escape, then should Batman kill the Joker? Yes. But to take that as an argument for the death penalty, really, it seems like a very ironclad argument for the death penalty if you're going to commit to a classic reasoning fallacy, which is the fallacy of analogy. And there's a reason that these fallacies have, like, been identified for 3,000 years is because, you know, people say, hey, and they make an argument that seems very persuasive, but the people who have studied speaking and thinking and persuasion and reason go, that sounds good, but we've done the math on it, and your argument is actually the bullest of bullshit. So many appealing stories. In fact, like, the reason so many stories are appealing is because there's a cleanness to them. You know, we get a tidiness in narrative that is so difficult to achieve in our real lives. You know, you watch these cop dramas. Why are these cop dramas, these mystery shows, why are they so satisfying? Because they always solve the mystery. You know, they always figure it out. There is truth, and truth is discovered. Like, when's the last time in your actual life that there was a complicated issue that you actually managed to fully resolve in a satisfying way so that you never had to worry about being wrong? You know, it just doesn't exist in the real world. I mean, it doesn't exist in the real world if you are a fully intellectually articulate, rational human being. If you are the sort of person that, you know, just listens to a political speech and believes everything and then goes out and puts people in a camp, you probably have the joy of certainty in your life regularly. But, you know, that's, at that point, you have stopped playing the actual human game. You're not actually a rational human being. You're just, I don't know, you're a type of automaton, in my opinion.
You're a rogue Iron Man suit.
You're a rogue Iron Man suit at best. Don't give him that much credit. You know, if you just listen and agree and obey with people blindly, I think you do have to turn in your human being card. I'm not saying you're a bad person. I'm saying that you have forfeited the right to engage in the decision-making process that will shape the course of humanity.
do you have anything exciting that you're reading or lined up? And also, like, I have a million questions about your reading habit. Can I interrogate you?
Yeah, hit me. What you got?
We've talked about I'm kind of, in the last couple of years, I've kind of gone all in on the Kindle. And the reason is, like, I just travel so much and I like having a lot of options of what to read and a lot of books with me, and the Kindle fits that purpose really well. But I also, if I love a book, if I read a book on Kindle and I love it, I will usually go out and get the hard copy of the book so I can sort of have it on my bookshelf and, use it as a reference and highlight the parts that I love. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
I have never read an electronic book.
Is it just sort of like a technical limitation of you don't want to get a Kindle or whatever? Or you have like a spiritual, like moral reason?
Part of it is the classic, you know, you love best what you love first. Part of it is habit. Part of it is, I will admit, to a certain amount of curmudgeonliness. But the big thing is like, I genuinely have no desire to read a book off a screen. Like, just absolutely. Now, are there logistical problems when I travel? Yeah, because I read all the time and I read fast. That means if I don't pack 4 or 5 books on a longer trip,
right,
I will need to buy books, you know, when I'm there so that I can read stuff on the plane home. But you know, if you lack the ability to plan, you know, to put 2 books in your bag, you know, then you kind of deserve what you get. I will just say that I love the book as a technology that is so well established that people fail to recognize it as a technology. You know, a book is a nearly perfected technology. I mean, you used to have clay tablets, but they were heavy and they broke, you know? And then you had scrolls, right? But it was really hard to flip through a scroll. And then you had books, you know, but there were some problems with the books, and then they fixed the binding, and then they learned how to make cheap paper. I mean, you know, for the price of like an expensive, you know, Starbucks coffee, you have a concrete story that the battery will never run out. Kindle will never pull it off your device. It will never seize up. You will never crack it if you drop it. Hell, you can even drop it in the fucking bathtub and it will dry out eventually. You know, it is the most, you know, if a computer could be as stable as a book was, whoever made that computer would make $1 trillion in a year.
Well, as a designer, that's always like, that's the most aspirational goal I can have, is to create some sort of user interface that's so good that people don't notice it, that they don't realize they're engaging with the user interface.
Exactly. A book is a perfected user interface. Now, again, are there things that could potentially be different? Absolutely. Potentially be tweaked? Yes. However, you know, and they've actually done studies, like really fascinating studies that have just come to light in these last couple of years. They found out that people's reading comprehension and recall are vastly better when they are reading a physical book as opposed to an ebook or anything read off of a screen. And there's a lot of kind of tentative theories about why that is, but I think it's actually pretty obvious. Because the truth is, we are physical creatures in a physical world, and we are really, you know, we're programmed to react and interact with things in the real world, and books are physical objects. It's sort of this bridge between the imaginative and the tangible. And because we touch it and we look at it and we turn a page, we physically interact with a book, it gives us more tethers in our memory. And it's, you know, I am a physical creature, and I, as much as I live in kind of a life of the mind, I love these tangible things, these real things. I love real world.
Now, do you write in books? Do you highlight, do you mark them up?
You know, I don't mind people who do, but I cannot really bring myself to, with the exception of like my beta copies that I print out deliberately to write in. I don't dog ear. I'm very, very gentle with my books as a rule.
That's interesting. I have always, since I was a kid, I dog ear the corners. I highlight things. I write on the page. If I have something that I connect, like, oh, this reminds me of that, I like write a note to myself. And it's very interesting because sometimes I can go back to a book that I read, you know, 5 or 10 years ago and like see what I was thinking when I read it. And that's as interesting as the book to me.
Absolutely. You know, back in the day, I might have like planted my flag and said, no, desecration of the book. But the truth is, like, in some ways, I kind of wish I was a person who wrote in books, because like being able to go back and read your own marginalia. Did you know that that's the term for that?
Marginalia. I love that.
And honestly, it's a huge thing in academia or any sort of scholarly research. It's not just like, hey, look, here's John Dee's library. It's not that like, oh, here's the books that he valued and read and owned. You page through one of the books from John Dee's library, and he has written in the margins, refuting or adding to research or just his thoughts and opinions. Those things are like more than diamonds. They are a treasure trove of historical information. And for people to do it personally, it's like way better than a journal or, you know, a review on Goodreads or something like that. This is like a tangible thing. You go back and you see the person you were reading this book. But I'm not that person. I love it when people do it because it shows an engagement with the text. It's every author's dream.
Well, it's, for me, it's also like, you know, I think there's an old fashioned way of thinking about books that comes from, like, I don't know, you know, 100 years ago, when this was like kind of before mass reproduction, when books were these like precious commodities and there were very few copies and they were handmade and they were these like beautiful, well constructed artisanal like artifacts. And that's just not the case anymore. Like, most books are shit. Like, you know, most books are not good quality. They're not going to last. Like, most of the books on your bookshelf are not printed on acid-free paper. They're going to yellow and decay, and probably they'll be illegible before you die, let alone like something you could pass on to someone. So with those kind of books, you know, the kind of books that you pick up at like a Barnes & Noble or an airport, those books are not, I'm not talking about like fancy art books or, you know, a lot of hardcover books are run pretty nicely, but most paperback books are just shit. And I have no problem writing on them. Like, it's the same as, you know, just writing on any paper to me.
Yeah, I'm very aware that for me, you know, actually, it was hard for me to even take the step into signing my name in a book. You know, when my books came out, I had to kind of get over that, because writing in a book, it's, and I'm very aware that for me, it's very irrational. It's a very irrational thing I have. It's happened more than once where like I drop a book and I say, ow, you know, like I'm reading a book or like it falls off the table or like it comes out of my backpack and I say, ow. And then I'm like, wait, what? Ow. That's a weird thing to say. But yeah, when that book hits the floor and the pages get bent, I think, ow.
I remember when I was growing up in Hebrew school, there's a Jewish tradition that if you drop a copy of the Torah, you would never drop an actual Torah, like the big scroll, but if you drop like a copy of the Torah, you're supposed to like kiss the book and apologize to it. And even when I was like 8 years old and I was in Hebrew school, I was like, oh, I was rolling my eyes at that. I was like, all right, come on. Like, it's just a book. Everyone calm down.
My sister worked in a restaurant. And the guy, it was called Pepino's, and the guy, the cook, I don't think he was a classically trained chef. He was just a really, really good cook. And his name was Pepino. And she would tell these little stories because he was a real character. But one of them was like, you know, like something happened and he, you know, and he dropped a piece of bread and he picked it up and he kissed it. You know, like he dropped like a little loaf of bread or a bun or what. He picked it up and he kissed it. And like, that was really interesting because he's an older guy. He's a native to Italy, you know, so we're talking old world stuff here. And it's, you know, that gesture is almost a gesture of respect and love, but it's also it's deep superstition. What you're doing is you're apologizing to either the book or to bread. Like bread is, you know, it's so culturally important that it's passed into the realm of myth.
But just as long as the health inspector is not there.
Well, I don't think you then put it in somebody's basket and send it out to the table. When speaking of the Torah, you know, the tradition, which a lot of people don't know, but I'm imagining you do, is when you're copying out a new version. Now, is the Torah just the Pentateuch, the first five?
Yeah.
Yeah. When people were copying it out,
it doesn't have the bonus scenes.
no deleted scenes or director commentary.
No.
Oh, what is the director commentary?
That would be the Talmud.
The Talmud, yeah.
Or that's the Haftorah. So when you do your bar mitzvah, God, this is so boring. Goodbye to all four of our listeners.
No, this is cool. This is stuff that a lot of people simply don't have access to this knowledge.
So it's, you know, when you do your bar mitzvah, you have to traditionally you sort of have to like recite the minimum of what you would do to be bar mitzvah, and what most people do is you have to recite a Torah portion. So mine was about Moses went to the Pharaoh and asked him to let his people go, and God hardened Pharaoh's heart. That's basically about the length of the passage that you would have to sort of memorize. And, you know, Hebrew is a weird language. You obviously read it right to left, and the vowels are all this sort of punctuation marks, and the vowels aren't actually printed in the Torah. You just have the consonant, so it's like not even like reading Hebrew. It's just sort of a reminder of it, so you kind of have to do the whole thing by memory. And it's also set to this... by convention, I believe it's set to this sort of musical notes that correspond to the words. The whole thing is set to music, and you sort of can read or sing the Torah. And then there's also the then if you're conservative like I was, which is like one notch up from the popular Reform Judaism, you also have to memorize a Haftorah passage, and that's like this long rambling, like people arguing over the crazy details of Judaism, trying to find loopholes to trick God. That's where you get into like the thousands of years of literal Talmudic debate over Judaism.
Yeah, and which to me, the fact that that is a codified part of the scripture, I mean, it kind of is in some ways, you know, the Bible as it exists in Christianity is sort of like that. It's like some of our traditional stories, plus also a lot of stuff that it's sort of like the good bits version that's been cobbled together and codified over the years. But, you know, but in Judaism, you've got, you know, a separate body of work, which is the scholarly discussion through the last, you know, umpteen thousand years. Which is fascinating to me. But the tradition about the Torah is back, you know, before you could take it to Kinko's and print yourself a new copy, it had to be copied by hand. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the rule was if there was a single bad mark, that the entire scroll was destroyed.
That sounds right. I remember there was a big event at my synagogue when I was a kid where they commissioned the creation of a new Torah, which is actually a huge deal. It's, you know, the Torah is a big scroll that's like, I mean, what's it as big as? It's, you hold it with both hands, and it's like as big as like a piece of luggage that you could, you could barely fit it in an overhead compartment on a plane. It's a big boy. It's a big scroll boy. And the paper is special, and the ink is special, and the pen is special, and the scribe who writes the Torah is special, and he has to like ritually purify himself before he writes it. It was a crazy process, and I remember learning about all the requirements of writing the Torah, and I was like, just print it on a laser printer. But you know, it's 2016.
What's really interesting though is I'm virtually certain that that is, you know, part of the process where, and again, think of this, people, they're writing in ink, you know, and you're doing this, and it's the whole first five books of what most of you know is the Old Testament. That's the Pentateuch. And so, you know, you're transcribing that not just faithfully, perfectly. If there's a single pen stroke wrong, you burn the whole thing. Not just, and it's a scroll, right? It's not a page you get rid of. You do the whole thing. You start over. And, you know, what's the reason for this? Well, because this is, again, like what Max mentioned about the way that it's written, it's a somewhat inferential language. And one of the huge schisms in the early Christian church stemmed from the difference of one letter in the text, in the scripture, which was, it was the difference between the homoiousian or hamaiousian. And one of them, it was talking about the nature of Jesus as he related to God. And homoousian meant that,
he was either the son of God or the son of dog.
You know, it's it's kind of what it comes down to. It's one character different, but one term referred to, it effectively said, he is of the same substance as God. And the other term would mean he is of a similar substance to God. So one of those effectively is saying he is the same as God. Jesus is the same as God, which is where the concept of the Trinity comes from. The other one says he is of a similar substance to God, which would lead you down a whole different spiritual and religious road. And these two factions, like, they fought each other until one of them was utterly destroyed. And you know which one won, because we do have the concept of the Trinity, and people are like, yes, if you get down to the nitty-gritty, Jesus was God. Jesus was God, his Father, Son, Holy Spirit, all the one thing, different things, but the same thing. Ooh, it's a real complicated thought there, and a lot of people argue over it, and they're not sure what it means, but those people won. I think the Hamaiousians are the ones that just got annihilated unto nothing. And that's where the expression, not a single iota, it needs to be the same. You can't change one single iota. It's the Greek letter I, which was the difference between homo and hamaiousian.
What I like about the Torah is, you know, this thing was like haphazardly passed down through oral tradition for hundreds of years, where it was like people were making it up as they went and changing it, and it was like a big game of telephone through, not just through many people, but through many, many, many generations. And then eventually they were like, we're stopping here. Like, this is the point. It's like here and no further. Now we write it down and we don't change a single mark, and the way that we remember it today, that's how it is always and permanently, and you're a apostate if you don't agree with one mark on the scroll.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I was, watch me do an awful thing. I'm going to bring it back to my book. I was talking about, I was writing up the culture for the Adem in Wise Man's Fear, and one of my very smart friends, one of my favorite people, name of Ian, also a big historian, library science guy. Just smart, smart, smart. He said, you have the Adem, and they effectively have what appears to be a cohesive, cultural narrative. He goes, but just so you know, things don't remain static unless you have a text that they refer to.
Huh.
And we ended up talking about it. And it's true, like, there have been many, many movements and many, many cultures and many, many religions and movements and all these different things. But what survives? Christianity? And actually, what version of Christianity survives? It's the one that developed the Nicene Creed. And they effectively said, here's the creed, everybody says this. And that's how that group of Christianity beat out the Arian Christians back, I think, in like 300 AD, 300-400 AD. The Arians, I really wish the Arians would have won that debate. We'd be living in a different world now if that were the case. And so my friend said, it's fine for these guys to have kind of an oral tradition and this spiritual belief. And, you know, they're tied into this mercenary combat and this way of life and this belief. He goes, but if this is supposed to be an established culture, they don't have a text, it's not really realistic in the long term. And that's where I came up with the concept of the 9 and 90 tales that exist in Adem, in Ademre. And I've written a few of them here and there. And I tell, it had a big impact on how I viewed their culture. And it made me realize that they needed a text too. Think of all the successful religions that exist today in meaningful ways. They all have a holy book. And they all are fiercely protective of the book itself and of the concept of the purity of the book, even in cases where it's truly ridiculous, like Christians saying that their version of the Bible is the perfect version of the Bible and all versions of the Bible are perfect because God is perfect and God would never let a bad translation of the Bible happen, despite the fact that there have been hundreds of translations and they've all said different things.
Well, as a Star Wars fan, I can sort of understand where they're coming from.
Okay. I need you to expound on that.
Well, it's just like I have the version I like and I don't like when it changes. You know, don't put any more CGI in there. I like it how it is.
That is probably the best possible ending we can have to this episode.